The Guardian.
Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes creating a professional website for your business, personal brand or portfolio so easy it's newsworthy. Go to squarespace.com and use the offer Guardian to get 10% off.
The Guardian Books Podcast with Claire Armistead.
Spins it back, just too far. Paulinho was surging forward. Dani Alves back in the box, looking for Neymar! And clawed away!
British man for 77 years has managed, but now Andy Murray has gone 5-4 up, three breaks of serve in this, and he will be serving for the match.
Michael Phelps is out by two body lengths and he's leaving the world record line behind. Surely this is going to be two in two nights. Look at him go, the champion.
With wall-to-wall World Cup, as well as the usual tennis and cricket, sport is pretty inescapable this summer. And we haven't even got to the cycling, which is my own particular obsession. Surely books at least can offer sanctuary. Not on this podcast, I'm afraid, though stay with us and we hope that we'll win over all but the most incorrigible of sports phobics among you. We begin by diving into the world of competitive swimming with the Australian novelist Christos Tsolkas, whose latest novel, Barracuda, paints a properly ambivalent picture of life in the fast stream. It's the story of a working-class boy with such prodigious talent that it seems inevitable it will carry him all the way to the Olympic podium. If only life were so simple. Christos read me a scene from early on in his hero's career.
He was standing in the motel bath, his speedos on, his arms clasped tight across his chest. His mother was shaving his legs. The lather was pasted thick on his thighs, on his calves, and she guided the razor through it slowly, carefully, not wanting to nick him. She said, "Don't move, Danny, stay still." He didn't like looking down at the soapy, filthy water around his feet. His mum flicked the razor into the dirty mess. Spools of black hair floated on the surface of the foam. His legs were covered in coarse black hair. He thought it was ugly. He was pleased the hair was being shaved, that it would be gone. But now the skin on his legs was dotted with pink blotches. "Don't move," she warned him again. He looked up at the bathroom mirror in which he could see his brother and sister sprawled over his bed in the main room. Theo was on his back, his neck and head bent over the end of the mattress, watching the television upside down. Regan was on her belly, her elbows bent, her knuckles pressing against her chin. Her feet were kicking up, down, banging on the mattress. He couldn't see the television in the mirror, but he could hear the voice of the race commentator. "Hurry up, Mum, the race is going to start." His mother ignored him. He looked down to see the razor scraping away what looked like a wad of thick, dark fur, as though he was some sort of animal she was shearing. She flicked the razor in the water again, and the clump of hair floated on the surface around his left foot. "Okay, that's that leg done." His mother smiled up at him. He was itching all over where she had just shaved him, but she poured some lotion into her hand and then rubbed it up and down his calf and the back of his leg. The cool gel instantly soothed the prickliness. "I'm gonna miss the race," Danny complained. He craned his neck, trying to glimpse a reflection off the television. All he could see was his brother's upside-down head, his sister's leg still kicking the bed. "Theo," his mother called out, "has a race started yet?" "Nah, you tell us when it does?" He could see the reflection of his brother nodding. The little boy caught his eye and gave him a smile, but because he was the wrong way around, it looked like a frown. Theo effortlessly propelled his body over the bed, landed on his feet, and ran over to the bathroom door. He watched as the razor scraped down the back of Danny's thigh. "You're really hairy." Their mother flicked some suds at him and the little boy shrieked, "Don't! Then get out of here!" Theo scampered back to the bed. "Should I close the door?" his mother asked. Danny shook his head. He thought it would feel strange if the door was shut, with his mother shaving his legs. It would feel a little sick. He didn't want that thought in his head. He shivered. "Stop moving or I'll nick you." If he was nicked, he would bleed. And if he bled, a scab would form and he would feel it in the water. He would sense it as he was swimming. It would be just a small sensation, just a niggle, but it could be enormous, like a fly landing on his naked shoulder over summer when it became all he could think of. All you could think of was that small trivial thing, but before you knew it, it would be the scab he was thinking of in the water the next day. The feel of it as the water rushed past it. An itch that would want to be scratched that would make him pause for a third of a third of a third of a second. But that was all it took. The coach said it all the time. For that third of a third of a third of a second to make you lose concentration, and then you would slip back, fumble a stroke, and then you would find yourself a quarter of a body length, then half a body length, then a whole body length behind. He couldn't be nicked. He couldn't dare be nicked. He stood absolutely still.
Christos, there is so much packed into that scene. Tell us about Danny and tell us about what this scene reveals about him.
I mean, Danny Kelly, you can't get, in a way, you couldn't get a more classical Australian name than that.
He could be called Ned.
He could be called Ned. And he's got a kind of dad who wouldn't have minded calling him Ned, I think. Scots-Irish on his father's side. But the woman who's shaving him, his mother, she's a second-generation Greek. So that's where the darkness of the hair and the body and what it means comes from. The other thing that is there in that scene is the fact that it's a really close family, that Theo, the younger brother, and Regan, the sister, they really admire and love their older brother, Danny. The other thing about that scene is it takes place when the Atlanta Olympics are on, and there are two Australians swimming the 1,500 metres, freestyle Kieran Perkins and Daniel Kowalski. Kieran Perkins goes on to win the gold medal at that event, and they're both heroes for Danny, except secretly he really wants Daniel Kowalski to win. Because he thinks Kieran Perkins is a golden boy and that Daniel Kowalski is the outsider. And why that's important is that Danny, and the reason that it's his mother shaving him and he isn't at a clinic, is that he comes from a working class background. His mother, Stephanie's a beautician. She makes a living cutting hair, and his father's a truck driver. But because Danny has this phenomenal talent as a swimmer, he's got a scholarship at a private school. And it's at that private school where he meets the golden boys. The golden boys with the luminous skin and the perfect teeth. That's where he begins to understand how dark he is and how hairy he is and how different he is.
Oh, it is a token of the way you write. You have these amazing set pieces. Another is the opening ceremony of the Sydney Olympics.
When I was conceiving of the novel, and there were so many essences. Clearly one of them was about what does failure mean, what does success mean? The other one is I wanted to write a book about class and what it means to be wrenched from one class and placed in another class and what's lost in that process. But as I was writing it, it also became a book about the nation I come from, Australia. And, you know, I did want to write about that, and it made perfect sense that because we had the Olympics in the year 2000, because I lived through that, because the opening ceremony happened and suddenly there was this euphoria. And I wanted to describe that moment as well. And so once I realised that the Sydney Olympics was going to be the centre of the novel. Everything else followed from that, you know, what age Danny was, where I begin the novel. So much of the novel's about shame. Danny does something very, very terrible, a consequence of this drive to be an Olympic champion that fails. You know, he never realises his dream. And so I knew that it was going to be a personal story about shame, and I knew that I wanted to write that story of how you come back from such a terrible moment where you commit something terrible, when you do something that seems almost unforgivable. Can you forgive yourself? Can you atone for it? Just being away from Australia and here in the UK, I realised that there's also a sense of shame that you carry as an Australian about something terrible that was part of the very foundation of the Australian state. And on a subterranean level, it led me to want to write about Australia as well. I mean, there were moments writing the book where I thought, why am I writing so much about Australia? What does it matter? That's not the story. But I realise now that's why, because I think there is that shame we all carry, all of us who are not Aborigine, wherever we come from, about what it means to be Australian. And it's because of a terrible violence that was there at the beginning of the country that we haven't, or the beginning of the settled white European settled country, that we haven't actually come to terms with, that we haven't settled, that we haven't made the atonement that Danny does.
Now, I'm really interested that you see the climactic moment as being that piece of shameful behaviour by Danny, because I would have said the climactic moment was when he loses the big race, and that's in the Pan-Pacific Games, because everything cascades, is building up to that, and then cascades down from it.
It may be in a way that, as a writer, you're blinded by the moments that are the hardest to write. The Sydney Olympics chapter was one of those most difficult moments, and I knew that I had to get it right. And the story wasn't about whether Danny became an Olympic champion, right? That's why I used a structure where you know that up front, you see the older man, and you know that he's never achieved his dream. So I guess the climax for me as I was writing it is what happens to Danny on that night of the opening ceremony. What demons are unleashed because of what that ceremony reminds him of what he's lost, of what he could have been. And it's the act that he commits on that night of the ceremony that became, for me, you know, the centre mm-hmm. of the novel. Mm-hmm.
Tell us a bit about this particular sport. You've chosen swimming.
One of the reasons I chose swimming is that I swim myself. I could write about the water, and I knew I could write about the experience of being in the water and as a swimmer. I didn't know if I could write about being a champion swimmer in the water, a swimmer of the calibre that Danny is, but I knew that I could write water. It needed to be a sport that was an individual sport. When Danny came to me and the story came to me, it wouldn't make sense for him to be a part of a team. And the other thing is we're an island continent, and most of us live on the edge of that island. And water is, no matter how you feel about home, Australia, no matter how negative you may be about it, when you're away from it, the two things that you miss are the light, and it's the water.
What water means is different. What the suburbs mean is different. What class means. You talk about WOGs, but you don't mean what we mean when we talk about WOGs.
Yes, in Australia, the word is a racist word, as it is here, but it was the word that was applied to the first wave of post-World War II immigrants.
Which includes your parents.
Which includes my parents, which includes everyone who came from Southern Europe and Eastern Europe to Australia, everyone who came from the Middle East. And in a way, it became a generic word for anyone who is not Anglo-Celtic. You became a WOG. And so my partner, whose parents were Dutch immigrants to Australia, was called a clog WOG. Something that actually I don't mind about Australia, that I actually quite like, is what we did was actually take the word and reclaim it for ourselves.
Let's bring it back to sport. And I actually went to Melbourne, spent a month in Melbourne earlier last year. I cycled along the towpath along the Yarra River, and you saw all these public school boys and girls in their eights going up and down the river and playing cricket and things. And I thought the sense of what sport meant and the relationship of sport and class, I was really struck by. We don't see the golden youth out in sort of huge numbers like that.
When I was young, I was in the inner city, and so the river was... I was on the north side of the river, and all those boat sheds are on the south side of the river, because that's one of the demarcations of class in Melbourne, is which side of the river you're on. And so on a Sunday, Dad and Mum would often take us for a walk into town through the river, and I just thought that, of course, those sheds belonged to everyone. I mean, they were out on the open, they were in the river, that anyone could use them. No one in my family ever rowed, so I wasn't ever going to be a rower. But I do remember quite clearly one day Dad taking us kids through, and he had no idea about who owned these sheds, and this man just barking at him, "What are you doing? You know, this is private property." Only once I went to Melbourne Uni that I realised, this belongs to these really, really elite students. It doesn't belong to everyone. The sport that I grew to love was Australian rules football. That was, you know, I'm using the term that was used, it was every man's game. And it was in Aussie rules that you suddenly started hearing Greek names and Italian names and Serbian names and Arab names. You still don't have those names in cricket. Around 15 years ago, there was this incredible cultural moment. It remains an iconic moment in Australian, not only sports, but in Australian history, I think, that it was, and it happened with Aussie Rules, which is a game that so much of class and race is embodied in that sport. Nicky Widmer, a terrific Aboriginal footballer, played for a team called St Kilda, playing against a team called Collingwood. Collingwood was the traditional working class team. It was the traditional, you would say, Irish team in that way. But it also became one of the most popular teams for the Greek and Italian immigrants. St Kilda was playing, they were doing really well. Widmer was just kicking goal after goal after goal. And he was subjected to some of the most disgusting racial abuse. You black bastard, you black C, you. St Kilda won that game, and at the end of the game, he went up to the Collingwood cheers squad and he raised his vest and pointed to his black skin, just this moment of pride. And I just remember how that image just ricocheted. It just, for so many of us, we just cheered, but it also felt like this moment where this Aboriginal man had just put the finger up to white Australia. It was a really important moment because so many of the Collingwood supporters were from all these different immigrant backgrounds. It just started this huge conversation in the Greek coffee shops, in the Italian coffee shops, in the pubs about racism and about what does Australian culture mean. And it initiated a code in the AFL. And I don't think I'm wrong. I think that's even before anything was happening here in Europe about racial vilification on the sports ground. And I think it could have only happened in Aussie rules. I woke up feeling passion. This time, it's my time. Don't hold back. Give my all. Unleash what's inside. Eat, breathe, and proud. I'm ready.
Barracuda is published by Atlantic. And now, on to football. Well, we could hardly avoid it, could we? It just so happens that our very own Richard Williams has been looking through some of the most interesting books to emerge from the World Cup. Perhaps unsurprisingly, a handful of them centre on the host nation, Brazil. Richard, you rounded these up for the Guardian Review, and I was very struck by how many of them use sporting stories to examine the state of the nation.
It's a little bit like the Olympic Games. When the World Cup comes round, it's an excuse to look at the host nation as a kind of historic and cultural and political entity and to see really where it stands. It's quite interesting how that works out differently in each case. In South Africa, obviously, 4 years ago, this was the new South Africa, the post-apartheid South Africa. Was it capable of building stadiums and running, you know, the pretty sizable infrastructure that's required for a tournament like that? And the same with Brazil. Now, Brazil, you know, is a member now of the BRIC group of nations, the emerging economies, and it would seem to be a good time for Brazil to host a World Cup for the first time since 1950, it being the kind of emotional homeland of football, if you like. So quite a lot of the books, like David Goldblatt's Football Nation.
Spelled F-U-T-E-B-O-L.
That's the Brazilian spelling pronounced futebol, and of course it's, you know, being Brazilian, it's probably the proper spelling for football now, I should think. And pretty much everybody who writes a book about Brazilian football uses one of those words, like futebol or jogo bonito, which was Pelé's phrase for the beautiful game. Goldblatt's book is more or less a history of Brazil told through its engagement in football, you know, through the various military governments and more socialist governments and so on, and how the game has reflected what's been going on in the country.
Another one of those is Alex Belos's book, which was actually published in 2002, I think, and is being reissued.
Alex Belos, who is a former colleague of ours at The Guardian, of course, and was our South America correspondent, lived there for some time, got to know Brazil very well, and 12 years ago wrote a wonderful book called Just Football, and that really looked at every aspect of Brazilian football. He started off by looking at the Brazilian football diaspora, the many thousands of Brazilian footballers, professional footballers, who play for clubs around the world. And I think he went to Iceland to start with and found a couple of guys earning money playing, Brazilians earning money playing football there. But he looked at all kinds of things, like the origins of the beautiful colours of the Brazilian shirt, you know, which were the result of a design competition in the 50s won by a very young art student. As they'd lost the World Cup in 1950 to their neighbours, Uruguay, a great shock, a terrible national trauma, wearing their original strip of white and blue shorts, and that they thought, we can't carry on wearing this, terrible luck. So they had a competition to design a new one, came up with the beautiful gold and green and blue one that we see now, which is so emblematic. It's a very multifaceted book and very, very enjoyable, and it's now a classic.
Now, another one from somebody associated with The Guardian is Fernando Duarte's Shocking Brazil. Why is it called Shocking Brazil?
Fernando, who writes about Latin American football for us and is Brazilian, chose to look at Brazil through their great defeats, like the 1950 defeat by Uruguay, for instance, and the other times they've crashed out of the World Cup, having arrived as favourites. And of course, in a way, it tells you more about them than the great victories, as defeat so often does. In 1982, for instance, they had what most people thought was the most talented team they've ever had, full of, you know, beautiful, expressive footballers. But they turned out to be, in a way, self-indulgent. You know, all they wanted to do was create beauty. They didn't actually think about how they were going to win the match. And that's a sort of a life lesson, and a lesson for Brazil too.
Taking a bit of a broader look, there's Andreas Campomar's Golazo, is that how you pronounce it?
Golazo, yes, which means, wow, what a goal! But Campomar has taken a wider view. He's looked at Latin American football as a whole, the history of it, and how the history of football in Brazil, Argentina, Uruguay, Chile, Bolivia, and Peru, and so on. It's all intertwined, you know, because they all began more or less at the same time, and they started playing each other in their continental championship and so on. But they all developed in slightly different ways, and they have different histories. And it's a very, very fine book. I really enjoyed that. It was the one that told me most that I didn't already know. You know, it's a very good book to read at the moment because we've seen Chile knocking out Spain. We've seen Colombia looking very good.
There were some anecdotes in it about the sort of post-colonial influence of Britain.
Well, I mean, football exists in South America because of British railwaymen and engineers and so on. There's a man called Charles Miller who took the first footballs to Brazil, for instance. Two footballs and a copy of the FA regulations, the rules of the game. Unbelievably, that's where it all started. And a lot of the clubs in South America have names that remind you of those origins. Like in Rosario in Argentina, there's a club called Newell's Old Boys.
So one of them, Maradona appeared for
Maradona
them, didn't he?
Played for them, yeah, briefly. And they're a first division club, you know, they're a proper club. And there are quite a lot of examples of that. You know, there's Corinthians in São Paulo, one of the great clubs there, at whose ground some of the World Cup matches are being played. They're named after the great English amateur side of the late 19th, early 20th century, Corinthian Casuals.
We have some particularly high-ranking football books. For example, Alex Ferguson's memoir, which topped all the charts last Christmas. But this isn't a thriving literature, is it? I mean, are there other sports that are in a healthier state?
Well, football did have an enormous boom that followed the publication of Fever Pitch, Nick Hornby's classic about Arsenal in 1995. Which was an enormous hit and spawned a whole literature about football. You know, suddenly people thought, oh, there can be intelligent books on this subject. Now, really, the interesting stuff is going on elsewhere, and particularly in cycling, which is going through a huge surge in popularity and has acquired a literature to go with it. There are some very, very, very good writers. Our own William Fotheringham, for instance, and Richard Moore, who's written very good books about the rivalry between Bernardino and Greg LeMond, a good book about Chris Hoy. Fotheringham has written about Eddie Merckx and Tom Simpson. There's another chap called Daniel Freeb who writes very good books about mountains. And there are a huge number out at the moment. Somebody's just written a very fine book about the Lantern Rouge, the 198th chap home is known as the Lantern Rouge. And if you go into foils, you'll see a whole wall of cycling books, whereas 10 years ago there might have been three or four books. Mm. now there's a wall.
And if you go into to the top of the mass market bestsellers, what do you find there? You find motorcycling. In fact, Guy Martin's autobiography has beaten Hillary Clinton into second place this week, which caused some crowing in some circles.
That is amazing. Motorcycling is a sport that isn't fashionable, has yet to have its moment in the sun, if you like, but it does have an enormous number of very, very passionate adherents who love the TT, because the TT is the last survivor of a kind of golden age when it was really, really dangerous.
Get it wrong round here and 9 times out of 10 you're dead. And that's a boss.
It looked like the most dangerous thing I had ever seen.
People might say that we've got a death wish. But what do they do? What do they do?
It is a very dangerous place.
He's come at 11 in total, just about to go there now, all heading down Bray Hill. We are underway just after 7 o'clock.
Many thanks, Richard. And now, anyone for tennis? As the rollers make their final sweep of centre court at Wimbledon in preparation for the annual tournament, we turn to cultural historian Elizabeth Wilson, who's developed her own special enjoyment of the sport to write a whole history of tennis. In Love Game, from Victorian pastime to global phenomenon, she charts the story from its origins in the late 19th century through the glamour of the Riviera, then amateurism, and finally the commercialised modern game with its many levels of competition around the world. But what, through all this, has remained the same? As Richard Lee asked her.
I think tennis is quite an unusual sport because it's, in a way, so theatrical, and it's also more varied than a lot of sports. The fact that you can have matches that go on for a long time, there's no set time for a match, and the variety of play that's possible because of the technology, the rackets and so on, I think it's, in many ways, an inherently more interesting sport than a lot of others. I mean, I know a lot of people wouldn't agree.
The scoring system is one whereby you've never won the match until you've converted that match point. So it's kind of this indeterminate thing, isn't
it?
Which you say gives a superior dramatic potential. But isn't it just that it's a different sort of drama, kind of more novelistic, kind of more baggy sort of drama, rather than the more tightly framed drama of a football match or even a match of cricket?
Yes, I think it is more novelistic. I think that's a good way of putting it, because you can have all these changes and ups and downs and toings and froings. And of course, you have that in, say, a football match as well. Somebody can score a try in extra time or something, but not to the same degree. And there's also a sort of mystery about this strange scoring system with love and 15 and 40. You know, why is all that? And nobody knows why it is. It's lost in the mists of time.
I mean, are there other things that are the threads that are always kept through?
The fact that two players, or possibly four, are in a closed arena puts a tremendous spotlight on the individual in a way that isn't quite the case with football, or certainly not rugby. You know, there are individuals, obviously, but there's a special intensity in a tennis match. And particularly today with technology, you have slow-mos and close-ups. You know, you can see every contortion and moment of triumph and torture that every player is going through.
It's always been a game that's been to do with relationships as well, hasn't it? A game that's involved women.
Well, it's involved women, which is rather controversial in many ways. And I think that is the fact of women on the piste, as it were, is part of the reason it's both controversial and very popular as a spectator sport.
I mean, it was originally almost a society thing to do, an aspirational thing to do. Something is that another constant?
I think it was, and to an extent perhaps still is, quite a middle-class sport, partly because there's simply nowhere for state schools to develop it, really, for the most part. And it's quite a complicated game. You have to have equipment, you have to have a special place to play. It's not like football, you can just play it on the street. So it's really bound to be a more restricted sport in a way.
You said that it's been driven by technology all the way through, from the lawnmower to the vulcanised rubber to the kind of the aircraft technology of the glue for the wooden rackets to, you know, carbon fibre.
I think in recent years, the technology of the racket has affected the game itself more, and not always in the right direction, in a sense. Perhaps there's too much emphasis on power and all the sort of more macho qualities of the game. I mean, it's still very exciting, but I think that's partly because we value science and technology more than art. You know, it used to be said it's a very artistic game, it's an elegant game, and it is. But perhaps today's sports writers or even spectators don't value that as much as the sort of scientific, oh, how hard they hit it, you know, how fast it's going, all that side of it perhaps appeals more to a mass audience. I don't know, really.
Perhaps it's also tennis trying to take on that allegation that it's some kind of sissy game, a game for men who aren't really quite manly enough.
Well, I was very surprised to find that there was this, particularly in the United States, there was this tremendous feeling that it was a effete game, it was sissy. And Paul Gallico, who's a sort of famous writer in the mid-century, was really quite abusive about it and saying, oh, they swish around and they're just pathetic and awful and you shouldn't be apologising or clapping good points of your opponent. You should just be sort of smashing them into the ground, you know, which I was rather surprised about. But I have discovered from talking about it actually to gay friends that there was that sort of acknowledgement. And one gay friend of mine, I remember him saying he was talking to a colleague and the colleague said, oh, well, aren't you interested in any sports at all? Not even tennis, you know, knowing he was gay. So there is a sort of underlying, underground sort of feeling about is it manly enough? And I think the modern game has perhaps a bit overdone the manliness, really. And the players, perhaps it's been most detrimental to our women players because now they have to use these power rackets and grinding away from the baseline. I don't think really favours women particularly.
But women have always wanted to take part, even when they've suffered terrible kind of discrimination or they've been, you know, even when the game was judged to be both at the same time too sissy, but
it's also too terrible, too difficult
for the poor women.
I think, as in many things, tennis kind of reproduces what's going on in the wider world. So tennis is no worse or better than other areas of life where, you know, there has been consistent discrimination against women and sort of denigration of women. Perhaps that's particularly noticeable in a sport, since sport is a male domain and women have always found it difficult to get into sports. You know, I mean, look at Arsenal won the FA Cup. The women won the women's FA Cup. Nobody hardly heard about that at all.
Another constant of the game of tennis is the domineering coach, from Teach Tennant to Mike Agassiz to Richard Williams even.
Yes.
What is it about tennis that attracts these Svengalis?
I do not understand that, except that I think it must be another aspect of the intensity and individuality of the game. Because unlike in a football team, you are all there. The coach may be bullying you, but you're together and you can to some extent resist that or mitigate it. Whereas a tennis player is all on their own, is all on her or his own, and often is in a relationship with a family member who is an adult and who is powerful. I mean, that wasn't the case with Teach Tennant. She was just a very powerful personality who coached Little Mo, Maureen Connolly and other top players who seemed to fall under her domination in a way. But, you know, I think it's not surprising that if it's your father or your uncle in Nadal's case who's coached you since you were four or something, that is a very powerful relationship and one that's presumably very difficult to resist.
Yeah, these pressure relationships can have dreadful effects on young people.
One female star, Andrea Jaeger, who subsequently became a nun, describes her utter misery, really, when she was a tennis player and her father bullied her and she just wasn't happy in this lonely situation where you're always competing with other people and you don't really have any friends and then you've got your bullying father on top of it, you know, so it's not always a happy situation.
When you find success, I mean, well, players like Tracy Austin or even Martina Hingis.
Yes. Who you know, eventually sort of fell foul of it, in a sense. But then, on the other hand, some players relish it all, you know, and love it. I think perhaps if you're a more outgoing personality naturally.
But you smuggle in quite a bit of context, quite a bit of cultural history along the way. Was one of the attractions of writing Love Game that you have a chance to put a dash of feminism, a bit of racial politics and a critique of consumer capitalism in front of readers who might not necessarily come across this kind of stuff?
Well, I suppose so. I mean, I suppose I would do that with anything, really. It's I've written about fashion. And no, I think the attraction of writing about tennis was that I'm a most tremendous Roger Federer fan. So that was really the impulse. I think sport in general is too much in its own little universe, in a sense. And there is a sort of, what I'm sorry to use the word ideology, but really there is a sort of ideology of sport that it's all wonderful and moral and character forming and all these things that in a way it's not actually. And I thought it would be interesting to put it in the wider context of the kind of world we're living in, really. And you could see that in, you know, I'm very critical of contemporary tennis fashions, but that's only because actually fashion in general is in a mess, really. You know, it's sort of incoherent. So you would expect to find that on the tennis court as well, really. I don't think it promotes some kind of heroism that sports people are superior to other people, which I think there is that feeling, you know, they are the heroes. And you never hear that about Ian McKellen or something, though they excel just as much and they've been just as dedicated to their calling, or Barenboim or someone, but you don't hear this thing about how they're these mythical heroes. And I find that rather tedious, really.
What do you think the players of an earlier generation, like the Renshaw brothers, would have made of Djokovic or Suzanne Lenglen? What would she have made of the Williams sisters? Are they still playing the same game?
Oh, what would have Suzanne Lenglen made of the Williams sisters? I think she'd have quite understood them because she was a celebrity. I mean, she really was a pioneer in celebrity culture. So I think she would have understood that. Suzanne Lenglen was an incredibly famous French tennis star in the 1920s who was a big celebrity. She, you know, dined with princes and went all around the world, who came to a kind of sticky end in a way. She retired prematurely for all sorts of reasons. But she was a fashion icon. Everybody dressed the way she dressed on and off the court, when fashions were similar on and off the court, actually. And she was regarded in the same way as, I don't know, Pola Negri or some sort of silent star, film star would have been. There's been a romanticisation of the sort of Riviera period and Riviera culture, and novels were written about it and artists loved the Riviera. So it did have a special cachet that contemporary celebrity culture doesn't have.
Elizabeth Wilson there. Love Game, A History of Tennis from Victorian Pastime to Global Phenomenon is published by Serpent's Tail. Thanks to Elizabeth and Richard Lee, to Richard Williams and Christos Tsiolkas, who is now back in Melbourne, but heading for Edinburgh International Book Festival in August. Next week, we'll be focusing on baby boomers and incipient poverty in Britain. In Guardian Weekly, they're looking at a different literary oeuvre, the story of Marseille Noir, how a city of sun and sea became France's crime fiction capital. For now then, I'm Claire Armistead and my producer is Tim Mabey. From the both of us, goodbye.
Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace, providing creative tools that help you bring your ideas to life. Squarespace offers free domain names, customizable designs, drag and drop tools, and 24/7 support. Squarespace also offers seamless e-commerce solutions for you or your small business. Every design automatically includes a unique mobile experience that matches the overall style of your website, so your content will look brilliant on any device. Start your free trial today. No credit card required. As a Guardian podcast listener, you'll get 10% off your new account by using the offer code Guardian.
For more great downloads, go to theguardian.com/audio.